Hello, everyone. Anybody here?
Yes, absolutely. Got Glenn and Cleveland here.
Good. Welcome to the today's call. This is Kurt Mortensen. I don't even know the date. We're sometime October 16th is the date. And this is the persuasion call of the week. We're going to take your questions and teach you a few things that will really help you out in the world of persuasion, how it's changing, what's happening, and, of course, things that you can apply right away. That's the key here is learn a few new things every week, apply them, and each tool you add to your toolbox of persuasion is going to make you an extra $2,000 a week. Does that work for you? $2,000 a month? I guess it depends on your tools. That's the thing. Every tool you add just increases your income just a little bit here, 2% here, 5% here, 20% here. That's why the more tools you get, the more successful you're going to be. So today I think I'm going to focus on a lower form of persuasion, which is called negotiation. Now, you have persuasion. Persuasion is what you do when you say. Now, a higher form of persuasion is influence. Let me explain the difference between all three of these. So we have influence, which is at the top, persuasion in the middle, negotiation at the bottom. Persuasion is what you do when you say. So you need techniques, you need statistics, you need stories, you need all those different things. Influence is who you are. So if you have passion, charisma, or trust with somebody, you don't need any facts or figures. You don't need any brochures. You don't need any websites. They do it because of you. So ultimately, the best form of changing somebody's mind is influence. The next is persuasion, and the third is influence. Now, we're always going to teach you to persuade first, negotiate second, and this is why. Persuasion, you bring someone to your point of view. You have persuaded them. You have convinced them that you are right. They're going to use your product or service. Negotiation tends to be more of a give-take, and you usually meet somewhere in the middle. Many times it is in persuasion you have a persuader and a prospect. In negotiation, a lot of times you have two persuaders, and that is a difference. Many times with persuasion and negotiation, and negotiation is one of those power tools, and it has different techniques. And as Chester Karas, he's a negotiation expert, says, in business you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. So just like persuasion, we negotiate every day. Where to eat, we negotiate with coworkers, we negotiate in real estate, we're always negotiating. And you know, if you want to define it, it's kind of negotiations when you reach an agreement, you get past an obstacle, you meet somewhere that's acceptable to both sides. And a lot of people say, well, it's got to be a win-win. And that's important. Because if they lose, they're never going to do business with you, and you're not going to get very far in the long run. And that's the thing. You have to really understand that most negotiation, most persuasion, we've always talked about, involves emotions, involves a subconscious trigger, multiple subconscious triggers. Anybody think that negotiations, let's say in real estate, do you think there's any emotions involved? What do you think? Just a little or a lot?
A lot.
Exactly, because we tell people it's not a property business, this is a people business. When somebody's home is going to foreclosure, are there any emotions involved there?
Yeah.
Or someone's lived in a home for 30 years, they think the house is worth a lot more than it actually is. And so negotiation, along with persuasion, you have to watch those emotions, the subconscious triggers. Because to really be able to negotiate someone, you have to make sure both sides are reasonable. Most sides are willing to negotiate, and both sides are open. Okay, that's very, very important. For example, logically, you can negotiate with any country, and it's pretty easy. Let's take divorce, for example. Now, logically, on paper, divorces are very easy to solve. Okay, you get this, you get this, you get this, you get this. So logically, it can be very easily, but why are divorces so hard for most people to negotiate?
The emotional aspects.
The emotional. It's huge. In fact, we've got people doing foreclosure. I've interviewed them as they've negotiated foreclosures. They found, let's say, for example, they found a foreclosure and there's $60,000 in equity in it. It's from a divorce. It's just sitting there. No one's doing anything. So they contact the husband. And it could be either way on this. But this example, they contact the husband. And they say, look, $60,000 in equity, I'll keep 20, you take 20, and we'll give your wife 20, and he'll say, great, sign it. And then he'll go talk to the spouse, let's say the wife in this instance, and say, look, 20-20-20, and a lot of times one of the spouses, the man or the woman, would not sign it because they would rather lose the $20,000 than let the fill-in-the-blank get $20,000. Have you seen that happen? If not, you will. If not, you will. So both sides, you have to be reasonable and willing and open to different scenarios, different solutions. And that's a big piece we've noticed with, as we train negotiators, is you have to be open that maybe your solution's not the best. You have to be open to different ideas. Maybe they came up with something a little bit better. You have to understand that many times in negotiation, there's some, might be some type of conflict, and people handle conflict in different ways. There could be, you know, conflict could trigger stress, frustration, or even anger. Some people avoid the person. Some people will leave. Some people will change the subject. Some people agree with you and never come back. But the thing I want to point out, a Chinese proverb that's very important for everyone to understand, and this is true with all your relationships, persuasion, and negotiation, and the Chinese proverb says, the man that strikes first admits his ideas have given out. Meaning when they attack you, well, physically, obviously, or even verbally, what's happened is they feel backed in a corner, they don't have any more ideas, and this is all that's left, and they're going to come after you. I was monitoring a negotiation between two seasoned professionals. They were both pretty successful. They were older than me, older gentlemen, and there was a standstill. Someone got backed into a corner. The emotions just got out, and this man said, well, I make more money than you. Okay. Goes back to the elementary school days. Well, my dad can beat up your dad type of a thing. Had nothing to do with the negotiation, but when people feel backed in a corner, the emotions kick in, sometimes some very strange things happen. That's why with negotiation, it's so important to check your ego in at the door. Know if they attack you or yell at you or they get angry, you're not getting caught up into that. Because if you defend yourself, they're going to attack you, then they're going to blame you, and then you're going to defend yourself, and it's a cycle that gets out of control very fast, that attack cycle. So one of the best keys as we go into the negotiation, you need to understand just some fundamental tools. Oh, someone too busy signal there. Is, let's see if that goes away. Unless that's me. Are you guys still out there, or is that me?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, all right. Let's listen into that busy signal. Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And annoying at the same time. We actually went to Harvard and MIT, did some training on negotiation, and talked to different professionals and worked through some different things. They said the number one reason people fail in negotiation is the lack of preparation. Such an easy thing, but most people just kind of show up, I'll see what happens. And this is multilateral country negotiations, any type of negotiation. The one that's prepared always gets better results. And in negotiation, especially like real estate negotiation, saying the right thing can get you an extra $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 pretty fast. So I just want you to understand this principle, that you're either going to pay with your time up front, or you're going to pay with lost money on the back end. Okay, so the prepared person wins. And it sounds like we've got some cell phones going out there. If you're on a cell phone or there's background noise, hit *6. We're getting a lot of feedback from you, especially if you've logged in the last few minutes. So this is what you want to prepare to do. The first thing is the obvious thing is your needs. Okay, what are your needs? What do you want out of this? Great negotiators think about their needs. Okay, why are they selling the house? Why are they selling their business? Why do they need this? What are they looking for? Most people don't even go there. You need to think about different options. What are some different alternatives? Your goal is to make the pie bigger instead of having that scarcity mentality. And we know that successful negotiators always have a mental rehearsal. What if they get angry? What if they ask this? What if they say this? What if they do this? Those are all some things that you need to understand in any type of negotiation situation. Also, you need to prepare mentally before the emotions get involved. There are any negotiation you go into, you need to have three numbers. I call this your win, W-I-N, or we call it your range of acceptance. Let's use a real estate example. Before you go into any type of negotiation, the three numbers you need are what you want. That's your best case scenario, which is going to be a little high. What you intend, okay, what do you think you're really going to get, and what you need, W-I-N. Okay, again, what you want, best case scenario, what you intend, what you're probably going to get, and what you need, what is the worst case scenario. Do this with any type of negotiation. If you are going to do use real estate, again, that's easy. A lot of negotiation happens there. So let's say you've bought a home for $200,000 and it's worth $300,000. So what you want is market value on $300,000. Okay, that's what you want. What you need to pay off some hard money, a few other things, is what you need. What you intend is probably $280,000. That's probably what you're going to be, $20,000 below market. It's probably pretty good. And then worst case scenario, you want to move it fast. What you need is $250,000, because that's going to make you $200,000. It's going to make you $50,000. You're going to have that now. There's other investments that you have. So what you want is $300,000. What you intend is $280,000. And what you need is $250,000. So when you go into a negotiation, before the motions get involved, you have three concrete numbers. The important thing is this, is what you want has to be high enough because they're expecting to negotiate. One of the worst things you can do in a negotiation, let's say you go up to somebody and say, okay, I'll pay you $250,000. And so they come up and say, well, how am I going to put this? Let's say, okay, you say, I'll give you $250,000 for it. And they say, okay, I'll take it. That's the kiss of death in negotiation because they've expected to negotiate it. And if you expect it too fast, there's a higher instance of buyer's remorse. Well, why did they accept it so fast? So even if somebody throws out a number that's acceptable to you, they're expecting to work a little bit. You'll need to negotiate back and forth a little bit to decrease that buyer's remorse, to decrease that dissonance. So the range of acceptance, what you want, what you intend, and what you need. Now that big number or that low number, that first number that is your want, is what we call the standard. This is so important to understand that if you're going to offer money for a property, for a business, for a product, whatever it is, let's say you're going in and offering $300,000 for a home, you need to have a standard. You want to start as high or as low as you can, but it has to be realistic enough to keep them out of the insult zone. If it's ridiculously low, if it is so low or so high that it insults them, it's not even in their ballpark or not even close, it hits the insult zone and it's downhill for you. So they say $300,000 is what you're going to sell your house for, and you have to have a standard. So when they say, well, how did you get to that number? You can say, well, based on this and this and this, that's how I reached the number. Okay? So it could be a market value. It could be an expert opinion. It could be your own personal formula. You can't just pull a number out of the air. And here's the interesting things about numbers. Is in negotiation, the odder or stranger the number, the more believable it is. Let me explain that. So instead of saying, I'll give you $100,000, you say, I'll give you $101,237. Okay? It's just more believable to people. It sounds like you've done your research. It doesn't sound like you're pulling a number out of the air. So I say $101,237. I say, well, this is how I reached that. Even though I've left room to negotiate, you need to start high. Now, here's a fallacy in old school negotiation. Okay? Old school negotiators will see you always let them make the first offer. We are finding through research that that is wrong. It is better for you most of the time to make the first offer. Now, let me clarify this, okay? If you are shooting in the dark and haven't done your research, you probably want to let them make the first offer. But what we're finding is, study after study shows, that when you make the first offer, you are creating the starting point for the negotiation. And the person that sets the starting point out tends to get the better offer because it's leaning towards you. You have your number that's as high as you can go. Let's go at $300,000. Maybe they were thinking $200,000, but you're at $300,000. Now they're starting at $250,000 instead of $200,000. So the first offer sets the starting point, sets the pattern for the whole negotiation. So what I'm saying is, if you've done your research and if you know the value of the properties or whatever it is you're negotiating, it does a couple things. It creates a starting point for the negotiation. It lets their guard down because they were taught the same thing, don't make the first offer. You're putting your cards on the table. They come across as more open. They're easier to negotiate with. And again, you've created the starting point to that negotiation. Again, contrary to what you've learned, but this is what the latest research is showing. Any questions on that?
That's very interesting. I'll say that. It's a comment.
Does it make sense to you?
Yes, it does. You're taking a control, but you're releasing an emotional valve, so to speak, when you start off the process like that.
You're releasing that emotional valve because if you start holding your cards tight, guess what they do?
Start tightening up also.
Yeah, they're doing the same thing. So all of a sudden, you're putting your cards on the table, which is great. Like you said, that emotional valve. They're like, oh, wow, maybe this won't be that hard. And then number two, you've created the starting point. Now, be careful you're not in the insult zone. Be careful that you have a standard. You've proven where that number's coming from. Well, let me tell you how I got to that number. I took this, the market value here, and I took this, this, and this, and I averaged those, put it into my formula. That's how I got the number. That is what I'm offering for this property. So you've released that emotional tension. You've created the starting point. And study after study, even negotiation seminars, when we give people different things, the first offer dictates where the final offer is going to rest, and it's always in favor of the person that's made the first offer. But again, if you're shooting in the dark and you haven't done your research, you probably don't want to make your first offer. You probably want to let them do it and see where they're at. But again, if you've done your research, it's okay to do that because you know exactly what you want, what you intend, and what you need.
All right.
Questions on that?
Very good.
Okay. Some blunders we're seeing, too, that'll help you out as things that will trigger people to hold their cards tight or not want to negotiate with you is a lot of times we get people complaining of perceived cockiness to where you think you're coming across as confident, but you're actually really cocky. The desire to destroy. A lot of people go into negotiation thinking it's going to war. They're going to stand. They're going to pounce on people. That's a big complaint. Having a poor agenda is a big complaint. Showing disrespect. I think a big one, too, is having conflicting styles. Because in persuasion we teach, you need to persuade others how they want to be persuaded. Because a big mistake people make in persuasion and negotiation is this, is you tend to persuade and negotiate how you like to be persuaded with or negotiated with, and you need to learn to adapt to different styles. And if you're not connecting with somebody, you might want to bring in another negotiator, you might want to take a break, you might want to learn different personalities. I know Steve's been talking about that on the calls, but that's a big one, is conflicting style, even revealing too much information too fast. We've noticed when we train lawyers, too, that a lot of times just revealing a little bit of information at a time is much more persuasive than all of it at once. A lot of people tend to, and you've heard me probably say this before, vomit. They vomit all the reasons why they should do it, and that just does not work well with people. It doesn't work well at all. So what I'm saying is check your ego in at the door. You want to make sure how you respond to conflict. You need to make sure that you have those three numbers, what you want, what you intend, what you need. It's okay to go first. As long as you have your three numbers, you want to make sure that whatever number you come up with, you have some type of standard that you can use. Now, this is really important, too, for you to understand. If you're doing real estate and you go up to somebody and say, well, what are you selling your home for? And they say $250,000, throwing out a number, and you thought it was worth $180,000, you say very quickly, okay, and you write it down, and then you say, well, can you just tell me how you reached that number? What is the standard you're using for that number? And this is the moment of truth for you as a negotiator. If they say, well, I just know I've lived here for 30 years, you know that they're just guessing. They pulled the number out of the air. They really don't know. But if they say, well, that home sold for that much and that home sold for that much and my garage has custom cabinets or whatever they say, then you know they've put some thought into it, and those are two very different scenarios the way you would handle those. Because if they're just pulling the number out of the air, you sit down, well, this is about the number I came up with, and here's the standard that I'm using. I'm wondering what the discrepancy is. And it's very different when you're talking to those two type of people. The biggest one that we've noticed that really throws people off in negotiations is they tend to fight on their position instead of finding the true problem. All right, let me explain that. Best way to explain it, let me see. Here's a couple of famous negotiation stories. We have two young girls fighting in the kitchen over an orange. The loving mother comes in. It's the last orange. There's none left. It's the very last one. So the loving mother cuts it in half, gives each half to girls. So the first daughter peels the orange and eats the orange, throws the peel away. The second daughter peels the orange, throws the orange away, and uses the peel in a baking project she is working on. And that's what a lot of people do. They just quickly solve the problem. Oh, cut the orange in half instead of finding out what the true position was. What is their true position? Another example, two hunters. They both shot a deer at the same time. They both want it. They're fighting over it. And most people say, well, just cut it in half. And that's fighting over the position versus the problem. See, the position is they both want the deer. But if you interview them, if you talk to them, if you ask questions, you can find out one hunter wants it for the meat, the other hunter wants it for the trophy. That's easily solved. Both parties could win. But sometimes we get so stuck on the issue or the problem or the position that we don't find out what the root problem is. And this happens all the time in negotiations, especially about the price. So if you offer someone money for their home, they say, well, I'll give you $300 for it. And they say, no, it's not enough. And you say, okay. And you walk away. Now, the position is they want $300,000, but you need to wait around and ask, well, why do they need $300,000? What is the real reason they want that? Let me give you some examples. Just hammer this point home. This is critical to your success. I was coaching with a student who was in Vegas, and there was a home that was probably worth about $280,000, but he went up there and $300,000. He knew of five other people that offered money, and this person stuck on $300,000. No one's ever talked to him. I said, well, ask these questions. So he had a list of questions to ask, and he found out the reason he wanted $300,000 is that, first of all, he kind of deduced that he had told all his family and friends he was going to sell for $300,000, and reason number two was that's how much he needed to get into the new house he was building. But it wasn't worth that much, but that's good information to know. Remember, great persuaders and negotiators ask three times more questions than the average one. So this is what happens. He asked a few more questions. I said, well, tell me about the house, what's around. And he said there was a couple of Sea-Doos, watercraft in the backyard along with the boat. And he said they were relatively new. They looked new. I said, do you like to go boating? And he said, yes, I do. And I said, that's pretty simple. You go up there and say, look, I will give you $300 for your house as long as you include the boat and the Sea-Doos. And the person says, done, you've got the deal. So he made a lot more than by selling it for $280, but he found out the problem. And then instead of fighting on the position of money, he was able to solve that. Here's another example. There was a piece of raw land that was worth probably about $400,000, but it was for sale for $500,000. And everyone has a position, $500,000. So everyone that went up to him will give you this. No, it's $500,000. That was his position. He wasn't budging. He asked the right question. What's the problem? Why does this person need $500,000? Found out that this gentleman was going to retire in 5 years, and to retire where he wanted financially, he needed another $500,000 to put into his retirement to make everything perfect. That's good to know. So we put a deal together and say, look, we'll give you $500,000. But here's how it's going to work. We'll give you $100,000 down now, and in 5 years, we'll pay the balance, the $400,000, and you'll have that for your retirement, which was even a better deal than getting it at $400,000. Because of the value of the property and how it went up. See, there's a position people always have. They fight over the position, and a lot of times it's money. A lot of times it could be the percent on the loan. versus finding out, okay, what's the true problem? Why does this person really need that? Position. Does that make sense to everyone?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Any questions on that?
No. Is there a favorite way that you have to kind of help them to be more forthcoming with truly revealing the problem? Or a method to kind of get down? Because sometimes if you try to go too deep too quickly, people have a guard against that. You know, they know that good salespeople ask a lot of questions, or they feel like they're being manipulated if you know too much too quick.
Yeah, there's a couple ways ahead of that. You need to understand that the more open you're going to be, the more open they're going to be. But if they're being really resistant to you, it's going to come back to a couple of things. First of all, it's either they don't trust you or they don't like you. Okay? Or we go back to the loss in activity. I mean, that's just reality. For some reason, they don't trust you. Now, when people trust you and like you, and you've been open with them, they're going to open up to you. So that's the best way to work out is a couple things here. You need to go back to law of connectivity and review that, make sure you can connect with them. Go back to the five C's of trust. But let me also talk about something very important here in this interview process. Remember, we're not salespeople, we're consultants. We're going to ask questions. And when they accept you as an expert, when they like you, they're more willing to answer these questions. But if you're getting a lot of resistance and a lot of no's, you need to remember the FITD technique, the foot in the door. Now, the foot in the door is where you're doing a little bit at a time. Let me explain this. If you're getting a lot of people to resist you, if you're getting a lot of no's, chances are what you're asking is too much too fast. Let me give you a study. This was done on a college level. They went up to students and said, we are doing a study on sensory perception this Saturday at 6 a.m. Can you come? Now, you're asking college students to show up Saturday at 6 a.m. Is that an easy thing or a hard thing?
Hard thing.
It's a hard thing, you bet. That's a hard thing for anybody, especially college students. And it was a small percent that said yes. It was around 24% that said yes. So they got a lot of people to do it. Now, this is how they change it. This is what's important to you. Remember, this is foot in the door technique, if you want to review it, FITD. The next time around, they said since they were getting so many no's, what they were asking was too much too soon. So what they did is divided it into three questions. This is what they did. We're doing a study on sensory perception. Can you help us out? Well, yes. It's this Saturday. Are you available? Yes. At 6 a.m., will you be there? Yes. It went from 24% to 52%. That doubled the number of people that said yes, they were doing it, just by taking one question and turning it into three. And again, if you guys are on a cell, someone on a cell phone, that's causing a lot of background noise. Now, with any questions in the interview process, thank you. I think that was it. You always start with the easy questions first. Now, if you know price is going to be the biggest issue, keep that last. Talk about, okay, well, what's the square footage? Or when is the day? When do you want the easiest questions first? Just like the encyclopedia salespeople that knock on your door. Their first question is, do you live here? Yes. Okay. Do you love your children? So you get a track record, you get yeses. And then as you build that connectivity and you build the trust, when you start getting to those tougher questions that you need to get them open up, it's much easier. So I'd look at three things here. I'd look at your connectivity. Are they really liking you? Trust issues, do they really trust you? And number two, are the questions you asking, do you need to break them down to smaller pieces, number one? And number two, can you rearrange the questions to do the easiest questions first to get that track record going? So instead of hitting price first, maybe you want to hit square footage or easy things or how they like the neighborhood. Those type of things are much easier to answer. Or you may want to get to some emotional questions. You know, tell about, you know, how many children have they raised here and what they love about the area. That sort of thing can also help you out. Questions on
sir. It's pretty straightforward. Very good information.
Thank you. Thanks.
You still there, Kurt? I don't hear much.
Hello?
Hello. Yeah, this is Glenn in Cleveland. I don't know what happened.